My name is Bobby Coyle. I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is June 2nd, 1988. My home group is the Underground Group. We meet at the Old Pine Community Center, 4th and Lombard in Philadelphia. Tuesdays and Thursdays at 8 o'clock. You see a lot of people at Witness Protection Program. They always come down to Florida. The Marshals will be here tomorrow to move you. I'd like to thank Don and the committee for the privilege, and it is a privilege to participate in Alcoholics Anonymous. Chapter 5 is real clear. I'm supposed to tell you in a general way what my life was like as an active alcoholic, what happened to me, and what my life is like today as a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. But before I start, I need to tell you that when I checked in on Wednesday, the committee was very happy to see me, and they told me how I was a subject of a lot of talk and humor. I was a subject of entertainment for them. The reason being, I come with a friend of mine. Right? Well, I actually travel with two people. But when I called, I said, listen, I'm bringing a friend of my friend. And so they went to the committee meeting. They took it completely out of hand. They said, Bobby Coyle's coming with his wife, but he's bringing his girlfriend too, and she needs a banquet ticket. And so I understand that particular committee meeting, every 2 minutes they were talking about my wife and girlfriend. I've never been married. I don't have a girlfriend, but, you know. But I'm glad I was able to amuse you guys. For your clock watchers, I have 2:15, actually 2:13. So I'll try to keep it. I got time frame, what I'm supposed to do. And this is it. I was born and raised in a very blue-collar ethnic neighborhood in Philadelphia. I got seven brothers and sisters. We had no booze in the house at all. My father did not drink, and my mother could not drink. My mother was pregnant for almost 10 years, 10 and a half years. She was. I got a sister who's 11 months older than me. I am 11 months older than my next sister. There's eight of us in a 10 and a half year span. We were one of the smaller families on the block. That was not unusual back then. We lived in a small three-bedroom row home, and I never felt a part of. And that's pretty tough to do when you got 10 people living in a small three-bedroom row home, but I never felt a part of, and that would be true even to an early recovery. My mother, besides being pregnant for all those years, was also suffered from a history of mental illness and abused prescription medication, and because my father did not drink, he was smart enough not to have any booze in the house. My grandparents, my father's parents, lived around the corner from us, and that's where all the family functions were held. Their basement was finished as a bar, graduations, christenings, things like that, and that's where I had my first drink. I was just a kid the first time I drank. I did not get drunk the first time I drank, but I remember what happened the first time I drank. I was running around the basement bar polishing off the half empties, or the half fulls, it depends on your perceptions. It was Ballantine beer. And I remember that because I remember going up to Connie Mack Stadium with my father, and Ballantine used to sponsor the Phillies, and they had the scoreboard in right center field with the three rings. And I was running around polishing off the half empties, and it was my uncles who pointed and said, look at Bobby. And see, that's what I always craved. I always wanted your attention, which was nuts because when I got it, I didn't want your attention, you know. But I was just confused as a kid. My drinking really took off in high school. Most of the kids in the neighborhood went to the local diocesan high school. But both my parents were first generation, both grandparents on both sides were immigrants. And you know what? The kids in the neighborhood used to make fun of my grandparents because of the way they spoke. But if you came to the neighborhood, some of you may think everyone in the neighborhood talks kind of funny. But I loved my grandparents. I loved them. There was always a party in their house. But they knew that you had to make it in this country was education. That's the way you made it. My father was one of 13. My mother from a much smaller family. She was one of 11. And and I had seven of my uncles went to either Annapolis or West Point. They went to the military academies, first of all, because it was free. But they knew that you needed education to make it here. So my parents had sent me to a private Jesuit high school. And right away, I felt kind of different, because most of the kids who went to this school were from affluent families from the suburbs. Just me and a couple of the dirtballs in the neighborhood walked to this school. And we had a reputation because we walked to the school, you know? And these kids are getting dropped off by their parents in their luxury automobiles, and me and the guys from the neighborhood were inside robbing their lockers. Now, I knew that was wrong. I knew that by the values instilled in me, by the nuns as a kid, by my parents, but the need for me to be accepted by you outweighed anything else. And I had a lot of nicknames, and one of those nicknames was Crazy Coil. And I would do things that, my God, I knew was wrong, I was uncomfortable doing. But I did it anyway because I didn't want to let you down, because I was like your entertainment. And I was just nuts, you know? And we did all types of things. Like, we did, like, we sold football pools, and if you won, we didn't pay off. Like, what were you going to do, you know? Or if you wanted to buy a particular substance, we sold you substitute substances. And what were you going to do? I mean, we went through more regular than a pizzeria, but, you know. And there was only 10 of us from my neighborhood. Like, we were scattered through all 4 years, but, you know, we thought we were gangsters, but we were idiots, you know. But I remember my freshman year of prep. It's September, it's football season, there's an away game, we rented a bus, there was drinking, there was fighting, there was police activity. It was really a lot of fun. And I remember my first day back to school, it was a weekend, the first day back to school, we all had to go sit at the disciplinarian. And he had us all lined up outside his office. It was all upperclassmen, except me and another kid from the neighborhood. We're the only two freshmen. And the priest came up to us. He says, "What's with you guys? You guys had like 2 weeks and you're getting this jackpot already." And I just shrugged my shoulders. I said, "You know, Father, just one of them things." And what it was, it would be the story of my life. Put in new situations, I found out, you know, I didn't play football, so I didn't hang out with them kids. Even though I did well academically, I didn't hang out with the AP kids because they were weird. I was about nitwits. And every time I was in a new situation, I found out who the nitwits were, and that's who I hung out with, you know. And that's the way I made it, you know. I didn't make the dean's list, but I didn't obey I didn't fail out either. I gave the bare minimum effort required to get by, you know. Now, this school sits on the corner of 17th and Girard in North Philadelphia. 3 blocks away is the subway, the Broad Street subway. Well, these kids from the suburbs used to have to take public transportation home at the end of the day. So they would wait for the trolley to come out Girard Avenue to pick up the trolley up, to take them the 3 blocks to the subway. And they would wait 20, 30 minutes for the trolley, which I thought was nuts, because they were afraid to walk through the neighborhood. Well, me and the kids from the neighborhood, there was a bar called the Ebony Showcase Lounge on the corner of 15th and Girard, which was 2 blocks away from the school. And when I was a junior, I was a regular at the Ebony. Now, you got to think, I'm what, 16, 17 at that time? I look like I'm 12, you know. As you can tell by the name of the establishment, I'm not from the neighborhood, you know. And I went there just to get cold beer. You know, they had dancers and they had cold beer. But a lot of times I went there to show these kids from the suburbs how tough I was, you know. I'm not a tough guy, I never was, and every time I walked out that street and I sat in that bar, I was terrified. But I didn't want anybody else to know, you know, playing the role, you know, it's just nuts. When it came time to graduate from the prep, I really had no desire to further my education, and I knew that ticked my parents off, because they didn't have much, and they made a great deal of sacrifices to send all my brothers and sisters to private school. So I knew I couldn't stay home, because there'd be hell to catch, and I don't like to catch hell. Love to create it, don't like to catch it. But my options were limited. I had no money, I had no skills. What am I going to do? So what I did do, I enlisted in the service. That really wasn't a bright move back then. Service wasn't popular. There were still guys living in Canada. But, you know, I enlisted. And, you know, after my training, I wound up getting sent overseas 13 months. And that's when my drinking really took off. I never messed around with other substances. I never even smoked a joint. I knew a lot of guys from the neighborhood who had gone over and got whacked on certain things. But I had a fear of other substances. But I had a drinking problem. I'm there a couple months, and several good friends of mine got killed, and I don't know how to handle that. Because in my family, we didn't talk about nothing. And once you moved out of the house, whether you went away to school or you want to get married, you were no longer privy to the secrets of the family. Everything stayed inside you, and everything stayed within the walls of the house. And if you moved out, that was it. And that's not a shot at my folks. That's just the way it was. We didn't talk about nothing, you know. And when my friends got killed, I didn't know how to handle that. But I drank to numb the pain, you know. And that's what booze did for me, numb the pain. I did not distinguish myself in the service. I didn't do badly either. You know, I gave the bare minimum effort required to get by. At this point, I didn't want any attention, good attention or bad attention. I didn't want anything at all. Just wanted to do my job and hope you didn't notice me. When my tour was up, I came home, I enrolled in school, wound up taking a couple civil service exams, and I started going to St. Joe's. Back then, St. Joe's is a small school. I don't think there was more than 3,000 of us through all 4 years. So it was about 15, 20 kids at most in a class. Going to St. Joe's, it was the end of the spring semester. Kid from the neighborhood called me up. He said, "Bobby, the Phillies are playing. Businessman special tomorrow." It was like one of those weekday afternoon games. He said, "You want to go to the game?" I said, "Sure." They're not going to miss me because I'm not an active participant in the classroom either. Not failing out, but not making the dean's list. Just skating by. Mediocrity was my goal, and I was okay with that. I mean, I just did enough to get by. So the Phillies had since moved. They're playing the Vet Stadium down in South Philly, right? It's the end of the spring semester, so it's May. It's an unusually warm day. Me and four guys from the neighborhood, we're at the top of the 700 level, drinking that cheap watered down beer, and the sun's beating down on us. I'm getting kind of trashed. I said, you know what? I said, I'm going to run down to the field and meet one of the players. They said, okay, Bobby, and they kind of shrugged me off because another nickname I had was Bullshit Bob. I used to tell people, I'm going to do this, I'm going to do this, I did that. I didn't do nothing. I sat in a bar stool and made stories up. I told you I should have started off Once Upon a Time. That's what I did. I told stories. So I had worked my way down there. They used to have these picnic areas in the left field and the right field corners. And I worked my way down to one of the picnic areas. I had jumped over the fence. I ran out in the field. The San Diego Padres were in town, and Dave Winfield was the right fielder for the Padres. And I went out and I shook his hand and said, hey, Dave, how you doing? And he looked at me, and he's a pretty big dude, right? He looked at me, he said, brother, what are you doing out here? And from behind him, I saw the guards coming. I said, Dave, I got to go now. So I start running towards the infield. I want to slide into second base. I don't know why. I thought that was just funny if I slid into second, right? But I was running towards second base. There was more guards coming from the third base side, and I knew I couldn't do that. So I start going towards first base. And at this point, I start walking, like to give myself up. And I don't know, as close as the guard, probably as Vinoya and I are right now, walking like to give myself up. At the last second, I think the guy ran out in the outfield. Now I'm running around like a screwball for about, it seems like 10 minutes, but it's probably closer to 2 or 3, right? But they couldn't catch me. I'm just home. I'm in good shape. I'm juking and jiving. But you know what? I got nowhere to go. The fence is 12 feet high, you know? The guards, the young, short, fat guys in South Philly, they're tripping over each other. It looks like Keystone Cops, you know? And I'm running around. I swear to God, up on the scoreboard in right center field, they put Mr. Excitement. They couldn't catch me. I stopped running. I'm about to get sick. I'm out of breath. I got nowhere to go. I wait for them to come catch me. They take me off the field. I swear to God, I get a standing ovation from 37,000 people. They take me up to the right field bullpen, and Tug McGraw was in the bullpen for the Phillies. Give me the thumbs up, like, way to go. Now, I knew I was going to get a beating from these guards because I made them look so stupid. They could have beat on me all day long because the way I figured it out, by the time I got out of jail, I go back, I could drink for free off this story for at least a week. Now, this would be the type of story that I'd make up, you know, Bullshit Bob, right? But I had no four dudes in the neighborhood who had my back. I knew they. I actually pictured this as I was about to get beaten. I said, I'll walk in, they'll be cheering for me, just nuts. Just as I was about to get my beaten, a Philadelphia police lieutenant showed up. He said, what's the matter with you? He said, are you drunk? Are you high? I said, no, I'm just happy. Just happy to be here. He said, well, you better get your happy ass out of the stadium. And he said, not only did he save me from getting beaten, but he saved me from getting arrested. And that was important because about 6-7 weeks later, one of those civil service exams kind of panned out and I got hired by the Philadelphia Police Department. They were hiring anybody back then. Now, I'm not even old enough to drink. The drinking age in the Commonwealth has always been 21. The drinking age at that time in Jersey was 18. And where I lived in Philly, I could be across the bridge in Jersey quicker than other parts of Philadelphia. But once I got on the job, I no longer needed to do that. Our mayor at the time was a guy by the name of Frank Rizzo. Frank Loveless. Frank, oh yeah, bank on Frank. Frank Loveless. There was 8,300 of us, and we were not more gang with badges. We did whatever the hell we wanted to do, and he loved us. He had our back, and it was just great. And I remember when he swore us in, he said, fellas, in your hand, you're holding the ticket to the best show in town, and he wasn't lying. I spent the first 10 years of my career up in North Philadelphia, where I would see the ravages of alcoholism and drug addiction day in, day out. And at the end of the tour, I would go out with guys of the squad and drink to numb the pain. Because I didn't want to tell them how I really felt, because I didn't want to be thought less than. I wanted to be one of the boys, to the point where I engaged in behaviors in my gut I knew was wrong, but I didn't anyway, because the need for me to gain their acceptance outweighed anything else. Now, I need to back off for a moment. I talk about that. I got to tell you why I tell that story for running on the field. First of all, it's the only funny story I got. So, that's it. I wasn't a funny guy. I wasn't an athlete, I wasn't a lover, I was none of that stuff. I was a lying, thieving, stinking, falling down, violent, drunk. And if I hung around you, you had something I wanted. I used and abused everybody I came in contact with. Secondly, it's a true story. I got those four guys in the neighborhood who can back me up. And thirdly, and more importantly, you know what? I was a blackout drinker from the very first start. I remember when I eventually got sober, I'm in the VA hospital, and the doctor came up to me. He said, listen, did you ever have any blackouts? I said, nope. He said, I must answer too quickly for him. He said, do you know what they are? I said, nope. Once he described them, I said, all the time. That's how I thought you had a good load. If you couldn't remember the night before, it was not unusual to walk around the corner looking for your car. Now everyone in the neighborhood's looking for the car. Hey, did you see my car? No, I see yours, I'll let you know. But it's just not. You know, it was fun. Yeah, it was just nuts. I remember coming on the corner the next day and guys would be telling me stories of the stunts I'd done the night before. I'd be repeating these stories like I had memory of them. I was a blackout drinker from the very first start. It was just nuts. So I'm working up in North Philly, and I loved it. It's a great job, and actually I think it's the best job in the world, you know. And but the handwriting is on the wall quickly, you know. I'm at work one day, and my immediate supervisor pulled me off to the side. He said, you know what, kid, you're smart. You're going to go places, but that booze is going to mess you up in one ear and out the other. I'm at a family function one time, and my uncle was a boss in the job, and he pulled me off to the side. He said, Bobby, I'm hearing stories about you. You're going to get yourself in a jackpot. You better take it easy. In one ear and out the other. Several years later, when I got sober on two separate occasions, I ran into that supervisor and my uncle in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I realized at that point that they were trying to 12-step me. And I remember talking to my Uncle Jimmy. I said, look, how come you didn't tell me? You know, and he gave me one of them old-timer smiles and said, you know what, you just weren't ready yet. Which just goes to show you that all the drinking and all the nonsense that went with it were necessary for me to hit my bottom. I was introduced to Alcoholics Anonymous in 1979. I don't tell people I went out because I never came in, but I'll tell you what happened. I showed up at work one day, and one of my coworkers was just drunk out of his mind. And on our job, we had a peer counseling unit, right? And it sat in this little house. It sat in a park, Pennypack Park. And part of this group, they actually had an AA meeting there, the 369 group. And I'm coming down the driveway. I come to work one day, though, and the supervisor said, like, my coworker was just nuts. He said, take him up to the unit. He's going to be detailed there for the day. I said, okay. And it's day work. I'm coming down the driveway, and there's a guy sitting on the porch. His name was Eddie M. And Eddie was the turnkey downstairs. I knew him well. And I didn't know he was sober, but I didn't know him well. And he was sitting on, they had these rocking chairs. And I pulled up. I said, Eddie, I said, I'm dropping this guy off. He's detailed here for the day. I'll be back at 4 o'clock to pick him up. And he looked me dead in the eye and said, kid, do you want to come in? I said, no, I don't. I was insulted that he even asked me. Because I knew what alcoholics were. Alcoholics were you older guys, you married guys, you guys with the three heads. I mean, I knew what alcoholics were. Alcoholics were these poor people I was dealing with day in, day out. I wasn't an alcoholic. I was insulted that he even asked me. I mean, I was a beer drinker. There's no way that you could be an alcoholic drinking beer. The only time I drank hard liquor was like on St. Patty's Day or New Year's Day or payday. But I was a beer. When I got sober, when I made one of my first outside meetings, it was there, and Eddie was there, and he smiled at me. He said, so, kid, you finally come around. And again, Joseph showed you that all the drinking and all the nonsense that went with it were necessary for me to hit my bottom. I was 24 years old and shot and killed a 15-year-old kid in a terrible situation that could not be avoided. You know, the psychologists now have a phrase, suicide by police, 25-some years ago, that wasn't available. I had a lot of help offered to me, extended to me, but I use it as an excuse to crawl in a bottle, and that's what I did for my next 3 years. I got sober when I was 27. Drinking took me to a lot of my nevers, and one of those nevers was the use of other substances. I wound up getting moved on my job, and I was put in this position. I was drinking. This is another never. Drinking, I never drank on a job before, but now the type of work that I'm doing, I justify that drinking's okay. And because of my judgment was impaired, I was put in a position where I thought I needed to do other substances, and that's what I did. And I love the way that Lyle spoke yesterday, because you know what? I need to clear this up. I worked with a lot of men and women who served with integrity and didn't do what I did. That's why I made some of the decisions I made, because I was impaired by alcohol. And I'm not blaming booze, because I still knew what I was doing. But that's the way I justified it back then. So, and then I got involved in other substances. My drug history is very short. It only lasted 17 months. It caused me and a lot of guys I work with a lot of problems. And out of the respect of the fifth tradition, that's all you're going to need to hear from me about that issue. Please feel free to use your imagination. I'm sitting home from work one day, and I'm reading the Daily News. There's an article in it that said, it was a series of, it was an extensive article, and at the end there was a little box that had a bunch of questions. It said alcohol problems, drug problems, depression, marital problems, thoughts of suicide. I was 4 out of 5. Because I was single. And I'm sure if I was married, I'd been batting 1,000. And they, you know, they talk about the moment of clarity. As soon as it came, it quickly left, though. But something made me cut that ad out, and I stuck it in my wallet, and I continued on drinking. It was Memorial Day weekend, 1988. Guys I worked with, we were in some trouble, so we went to a bar to get our story together. And one of the guys I was with decided that he was going to drive home. God forbid he'd take her some sort of family obligation or whatever. And I decided I would give him a ride home because I did not think that I was as drunk as he was. And I'm a show-off. I always was an arrogant guy. I was very aggressive on the job, you know, and just in case you happen to miss my latest exploits, I would have a copy of the paper in the car. I'd be more than happy to autograph it for you if you were interested. So I'm going to show off my driving skills because I would see things in television or in the movies. Says, I could do that. They do that. I could do that. Now, I know everything's prearranged on people and all that other stuff, but I didn't know that. I didn't care because I'm not driving my car. And I had this city car, and so I decided I wasn't as drunk as this guy was, and I was going to give him a ride home, and unfortunately, he thought that was a good idea. So I'm coming up the street, driving down Poplar Street. It's a one-way street, and there's a big stone wall on my left-hand side, and I saw a kid riding towards me on a bicycle. And for some reason, I thought it would be funny to see this kid jump the curb and grab the wall. I don't know why. I just thought that would be funny. So I decided to play chicken with this kid. And unfortunately, at the last second, we turned in the same direction. I ran this kid over. As he lied, bleeding on the hood of my car, I got out of my car on my nightstick. I was going to beat this kid because I thought he was milking me and the city for an insurance claim. The guy that I was with prevented me from doing that. I took this kid off the hood of my car, threw him off the side of the street like a piece of trash. I pulled his crumpled bicycle from underneath my car, threw that off the side of the street like a piece of trash. I drove back to the bar, made some sort of smart aleck remark, and I continued on drinking. When I came to the next day, I realized I was in serious, serious trouble, but I didn't think anybody would help me because I was such a creep. And believe me, I was a creep, you know, and I didn't know what to do. So what I did do, I got a bottle of liquor, a case of beer, and some other substances, and I checked into a hotel with the intention to consume all this stuff to build up the courage in my life. And 3 days later, all the stuff is gone. All the booze is gone. All the other stuff is gone. And they're knocking on the hotel door to kick me out. And at this point, I'm suspended from my job, so I no longer have access to my weapons, so I can't shoot myself. So I walked over to the window, and I was going to jump out the window. And I opened up the window. I was on the 5th floor, and I remembered I was scared of heights. I made 23 jumps. I never overcame my fear of heights, you know. So I went in the bathroom, and I filled the bathtub with water, and I had a blow dryer. I was going to put a blow dryer in the tub to make it appear an accidental electrocution. But every time I would put a blow dryer in the tub, it would come unplugged. I was about 1.5 feet short on cord. And I got 1 foot in the tub, and I'm leaning trying to plug it in, you know. And it's like that scene out of Woody Allen movie where he couldn't even kill himself, you know. And it's okay to laugh, but, you know, I never want to forget the pain I was in that day. So the only other tool that I had left was my car. So I took one last spin through the neighborhood. I start up the Falls Bridge, and I come down the East River Drive, which is a winding road along the Schuylkill River. And it was a weekday, a mid-morning weekday, because that would be important, because if this was any other time of day, I'd probably succeed when I set out to do, which was to end my life in an automobile accident, you know. And I handle jobs like that. I know, you know, it's a winding road. I think the speed limit was 20, you know, and it's just a dangerous road. And I'm doing 50, and I'm cooped. I'm out of my mind, you know, hungover, and I figured this would end quickly. Then I had remembered something happened when I was young. I was about 22, 23 years old. And I remember I knocked on this guy's door. I told him that his son was killed in an automobile accident. And he was an older guy. To me, at that time, everything's relative. He looked like he was probably in his late 30s, early 40s to me. And the only way I can describe it, I can still picture this yesterday. It was like 20-some years ago. He slumped against the door, and I actually saw like the life leave this guy's eyes, you know. I was in court a few weeks later. I didn't even recognize the guy. He was there for, you know, he pulled me over the hallway and started talking to me. I didn't even recognize the guy. He just aged. I now know that was God. I didn't know that then. But as much pain that I was in that day, I thought back on this incident, I knew that I could not cause this type of pain on an innocent family. But I still needed to end my pain. So I decided I would wrap myself around one of them trees. Some trees tend not to move. You hit them at a pretty good rate of speed, you know. And sometimes a car splits in half, or if you're not belted in, you usually get ejected from the vehicle, struck by another vehicle. That usually does the trick. And by then I just lost it. I just started crying, you know, and I was just a complete mess. And I finally pulled over at the end of the East River Drive, was Boathouse Road. And I sat behind the wheel of my car and I cried like a baby for about 10 minutes. And I reached into my glove box where I always had an extra gun, and that wasn't there. But my glove, but my wallet was in the glove box, and inside that wallet was an article that I had clipped out of the Daily News about 6 weeks before. And it's no longer there, but at the end of the last boathouse, it was one of these old glass enclosed phone booths. And I walked over that phone booth and I dialed that phone number on that ad. And the woman who answered the phone, I spoke to this lady like I spoke to no one in my life before. I told her the truth. I told her everything that was going on in my sad, miserable life, and God bless her, she listened patiently. And when I got done, she said, "Listen, why don't you drive over to Hahnemann Hospital? Somebody will be waiting to talk to you." And that was about a 5-6 minute drive. I said, "Okay." And I drove over to Hahnemann, and they were waiting for me. They admitted me to their 10th floor psychiatric unit. And they kept me there for about 3 or 4 days. And from there, I got transferred to the VA hospital out in West Philadelphia, where I would spend about 6 weeks in their flight deck. And from there, I got transferred to the VA hospital out in Coatesville, where I would spend another few weeks on their flight deck before I got put into an alcohol and drug ward. When I pulled over that day and made that phone call, Alcoholics Anonymous was the furthest thing from my mind. I didn't think I had a problem with alcohol. I thought my problem was short use of other substances. If I left that crap alone, I'd be okay. Maybe I got this mental illness. I heard this from my mother. Maybe this stress stuff I got, you know, they're now talking about. I got it from the job or got the experience in the service. Maybe it's the neighborhood I live in. Maybe it's the fact I'm a mummer. I don't know. But it can't be alcohol because I'm a beer drinker. There's no way that you could be an alcoholic drinking beer, you know? So I finally got put in the alcohol and drug ward at the VA hospital, and I'm there about 20 minutes, and I get the lay of the land, and I start scouting out because I'm finally in a place that has handles on both sides of the door. And and the arrogance creeps back in. So this, I've probably got about 8 to 10 weeks in various nut wards under my belt. So I make my way down into the day room, and in the day room, up on the wall, they had the large window shades of the 12 steps of the 12 traditions, right? I zip through the steps. I got about 6 of them done. I see the amends. I said, "No, I don't do that. You know, we don't have, no, wrong guy, wrong neighborhood. We don't know amends and X that off." But later that night, two men came up, and I would later find out that they were part of the treatment facility committee. I did not know that then. They came up to carry the message of Alcoholics Anonymous. The moment that the speaker said something as bad as background that I did not identify with, could not relate to, or just didn't like, I'd immediately tune him out. I was too busy listening to the messenger, not the message. Then I'm looking around the room, and I realized I probably a little quick, pulled the trigger, no pun intended, probably a little quick in seeking treatment. You know, I said, "Man, I'm really not bad at these guys, you know." I'm looking at these guys had wives who hated them, kids they couldn't see, you know, PFA orders, things like that. I didn't have that problem. Probably due to the fact I'd never been married and didn't have any children, may have had something to do with that. A lot of these guys had job problems, you know, I never had that. I only had 2 jobs in my life. I went from the high school to the Air Force to the city, the police department. Never worked for anyone else, you know. A lot of these guys had legal problems. I didn't have any yet, you know. I'm looking for the differences and not the similarities. But what bothered me the most, without any question, was at the end of the meeting when everyone got in a circle and held hands and said the Lord's Prayer. "If this is what your people are about, I didn't want nothing to do with you because I hated God." And I always tell people, I know they're strong words, but you know what? It doesn't even begin to sum up the feelings towards God. I hated God, and believe me, it was a legitimate hate for several good reasons. One of those reasons, I talk about my mom's mental illness. My mom was a fundamentalist in the church, you know, and she was in the charismatic movement. She thought she could speak in tongues and things like that. And I was 15 years old. I came home from school one day. I'm in the house about 10-15 minutes. And I finally came across my mother. I found my mother. She had slit her wrist. And I remember she looked up at me. She said, "Bobby, help me." I looked down at her and said, "Good for you." And I walked out of the house. And I got an older guy to go to the state store and buy a bottle of wine. And I drank the wine. And I came home later that night. My father told me what happened. I acted surprised. "Oh, yeah, how about that?" So that happened when I was 15. I got sober when I was 27. That's 12 years of hating God. And believe me, that's a real good hate, 12 years, you know. It'd be a few more years before I would even address this. So I ain't holding hands and I'm not saying any prayers, you know. So I break away from the circle and just stand there. I'm about to get discharged and a nurse coming up to me, and please, I'm about to say this, it's not to get a laugh. She had to be a member of Al-Anon. She was just a beautiful lady. She saw all through my BS. And she came up to me and she said, "The only way you're going to make it, you're going to need to go to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I need to tell you that's the best piece of advice I got. And that's where I would get my recovery. I got it in Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't get it in the VA hospital. The VA hospital does great work. They helped me with lots of things, you know. They drained the oil, they tightened the bolts. They did good work. But I would get my recovery in AA. And I went to AA every single day, sometimes 2 or 3 times a day. I don't drink coffee. I've never had in my life, so I don't make it. I I don't smoke cigarettes. Never have in my life. So I don't empty ashtrays. Don't have to worry about that anymore. But back then, I didn't empty ashtrays. I walked into a big book meeting or step meeting that was strictly by accident. I would leave at the break. I had something more important to do. Tradition meetings, rules. My line of work, we love to enforce them. We don't like to follow them. They're for other people. I was interested in war stories. And the moment that the speaker said something about his background that I didn't like, couldn't relate to, I didn't identify with, I immediately tuned him out. Too busy listening to the messenger, not the message. So my very first outside meeting, clear as a bell, a guy and a wife, a man and woman, they're married couple, 10 years sober, both celebrating their 10th anniversary. The wife has one more day than her husband, and she constantly reminded them of that throughout their story. Now, I need to tell you, my neighborhood I grew up was a very blue-collar ethnic neighborhood. It's gone through a gentrification process. You know, and them yuppies come in and they ruin everything. They, you know, abandoned warehouses, they turn into beautiful loft apartments. You know the stuff they do, right? Well, you know, it happened in AA. You know, they say AA is a microcosm society. Well, so the neighborhood, now the meetings are kind of yuppies. I don't know no one in the meeting, you know. But there's a dude from my neighborhood, his Troubles. Believe me, that's a harder nickname. You get a nickname like Troubles, that's a harder nickname. He was sober. I knew this guy. He was in and out of jail in the 60s and 70s. I thought he was still in prison. I thought he was dead. I had not seen him in years. And here he was, sober and Alcoholics Anonymous. Because I did not believe the man and the woman who had 10 years. I said, come on. Maybe you go over to Jersey and drink and keep your Pennsylvania time. I don't know. I call him 10 years. That's a stretch. I mean, I couldn't. But Troubles was sober 2 years. I said, man, he's sober? I was more impressed with him. I need to tell you, that's the only reason I came back to AA, because Troubles was sober. I did everything wrong you could do in Alcoholics Anonymous. The only thing I didn't do, I didn't pick up a drink. I sat in this bar one day, right? Because they sold real good roast beef, right? And I'm drinking. And I'm drinking soda out of a rock glass. And, well, that's why I would tell you back then. But the truth was, because I was an arrogant guy and I got a lot of press. Well, as you can imagine, towards the end of my drinking, I got a lot of negative press. And the reason I'm there in the bar that day was, whoa, I don't know who that guy was. Mistaken identity. Not me. I'm back. Things are cool. That's why I was in the bar. A couple guys from the neighborhood came in. They start breaking my, busting my shoes. Start giving me a hard way to go. And it was necessary, but it was knocking me down a couple of pegs. I couldn't understand where they're coming from. I could relate to that. But unfortunately, the one dude got a little too close to me, and I stood up and I punched him in the face with a rock glass, and I dropped him. I opened him up. He bled like a pig. And I knew the wagon crew that came in to handle the job. I knew one of the guys, and he pulled me off to the side. He wanted to hear my version of the story, and I told him. And I can still picture the look of disgust in his eyes. And he looked at me. He said, get the hell out of here. You know, I mean, I could have got pinched. That would have been a serious job, but, you know, and I got out of there. And that's where I learned my lessons about people, places, and things. And I have since found a place that sells real good roast beef without being that type of environment. But that's how nuts I was, you know. I celebrated my first anniversary, and it was amazing. I got done speaking because in my home group at that time that you told your story when it was your anniversary, I got done speaking. It was amazing. Thunderous applause, the blind could see, the lame walked. It was truly miraculous. And the people came up and they patted him in the back and said, Bobby, you're doing so good. I lied during my entire story. The fact that I identified myself as an alcoholic because in my home group you couldn't talk about that other stuff. And I didn't believe I was an alcoholic. See, I was a pretty sharp guy. I knew what you wanted to hear, so I gave you all the quotes out of the big book, the 12 on 12. Sounded like the second coming of Bill, right? But during my story, a bottle of beer appeared in my head. But you guys didn't want to hear that. You wanted to hear all the good stuff, you know? And that's how nuts I was. I was sober 23 months. I beat it on a man with a baseball bat. Forget what step I was working that day. But I was nuts. Stone cold sober in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous as a liar, thief, and a cheat. I was a creep with the new women. No one asked me to be their sponsor. No one wanted what the hell I had. I didn't carry the message. I carried the disease. My early recovery, the first couple years, right? I used to go to like a lot of gentlemen's clubs. I drank soda. It was cool. I would get my picture taken with the entertainer, right? And come to meetings and pass the picture around to the old-timers because I know they would like that. They would look at the picture, right, and look at me, and they would just shake their head. I said, please, kid, please keep coming back. I said, okay, I'll keep coming back. I was just nuts. It was crazy. You know what? Back home, everyone goes to the diner. There's like a diner just on every other corner. If there's not a tap room, there's a diner, you know? And guys will come up, and after the meeting, we go to the diner. And people, you know, you would have to run me over to get out of the meeting. So I made sure that you invited me to go. They say, Bobby, we're going to the diner. You want to go? I say, nope. But God forbid you never invite me, because then I have an attitude, you know? And I'm just nuts, you know? I would share crazy things. Serene people scared the hell out of me. If I was in a serene meeting, a real spiritual, I tell you, the worst meeting to go to? Sunday night after retreat. Worse. Horrible. I'd be at the Friday night meeting, right? No one would be there. I said, man, half the crowd's going, where the hell is everyone at? Saturday night, the same thing. I said, man, where's everyone at? Sunday night. I said, oh, here they come. They come floating in. I said, oh, they're all... they're all at Malvern this weekend. Here they come. I said, oh, man, they come floating in. And I said, I never left the meeting. I don't know why. That's probably the only good thing I did, you know. Not that I did much good sober, but I never left me. And people would come in, and they'd be elevated, and they'd be talking. And it was just, I'm very uncomfortable. Well, you know, and so that's when I would get my hand up and share my insanity. Then I'd sit back and watch the show, because serene people scared me. I was just nuts. I couldn't deal with that. You know, I can never sit still. You know, they came up and they tricked me one day. And the way you trick to a newcomer is you don't give them a chance to formulate the lie. They come up and they say, Bobby, they caught me off guard. They said, you working this weekend? I said, nope. And I knew that was the wrong answer. They said, good, because we're going on a retreat this weekend and we're going to take you with us. Oh, man. Now, the truth is, I'm making fun of these guys, but you know what? They were good men. They were decent men. They tolerated my nonsense. They put the hand of AA out there time and time again, and I was the nitwit who slapped it away and then talked about it. I was just nuts, right? But these guys are walking the walk. So I was sober long enough in Alcoholics Anonymous to know that you couldn't get kicked out. But I was also sober long enough in Alcoholics Anonymous, and this is only my personal experience, that not everyone is always greeted as warmly as the next person, for either one reason or the other. Just my personal experience. So I couldn't tell these guys about my mom. I mean, like, what would they really think about me, you know? So we go into this retreat Friday afternoon. I'm in the back seat. I got a big eyelid side of me. It's like role reversal, because at work I drive, you're in the back seat, right? So I got a big guy on each side of me. And the closer we get to the retreat house, the bigger the knot gets in my stomach. But I can't tell these guys. But you know what? I knew that I was safe with these guys. I just couldn't get honest with them. You know, it was all me. So we get there. It's like about 4:30, 5 o'clock. They say, we want to introduce you to the retreat master. I said, oh, come on. All right, let's get this over with, right? So they take me down this long carpeted hallway. They knock on this door. Guy says, come in. I come in. He stood up. He puts his arms out. He's my disciplinarian from high school. But not only that, but he's also a longtime member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And he gives me a hug and he wants to know what's going on. And I'm giving him the 411. You know, I'm letting him know where I'm going to meetings and stuff, right? And then he says, who's your sponsor? I says, I don't have one. Because I'm a pretty bright dude. He knew that. He knew I was a bright guy. He said, well. He said, well, I strongly suggest you get a sponsor. So I asked my roommate to be my sponsor. God forbid should I ever be questioned again. Bobby, who's your sponsor? There he goes right there. I never talked to this guy. The only time I talked to him is when I accidentally bumped to him in the meetings. He said, Bobby, I still got that same phone number. I said, yeah, I'll give you a call. You know what? I never called him. Know what I used to do? I used to talk to people about this guy. I said, oh, you won't believe this guy. He wants me to do this. He wants me to do that. He didn't do nothing. He put the hand of AA out there. I slapped it away and I character assassinated the guy to boot. That's how nuts I was. I told you I was goofy. My second anniversary come, I didn't celebrate it. A month after my second anniversary, I wanted to eat my gun. The same pathetic feeling I had 25 months before, but 25 months before I'm loaded with drugs and alcohol. Here I am, stone cold sober in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. I want to eat my gun. Safe to assume my life was unmanageable. I hated everybody. But you know who I hated the most? I hated the new people. I know you're not supposed to say that, but that's what I did. New people are the most important. I hated them the most. We have a court board in the group. Court board, first name, last initial, date of month, years you're celebrating. If Joey A had 3 years and Bobby C had 2, and Joey A went out, I said, good for him. He's out, I'm in. It's about time, because that's all we talk about. How much time you got? How much time you got? How much time you got? He's out. I'm in. Good. He's out. I was just nuts. This is crazy. But the reason I hated the new guys, the truth was, Because at this point, okay, I'm sober two years. You tell me you got 10. I said, all right, I know you two. I'll spot you the other 8. You say you got it. You got it. That's it. But these people who came in, I saw these guys come in. They were rambling idiots. I mean, they were just a mess. And I saw them get better before my eyes. So I knew they were for real. So I hated them the most. The reason they got better before me, because they were willing to take some action and I was afraid to take. And that's it. God's honest truth, I was afraid. Fear was running my life. Even though I may have tried to portray it was other things, it was fear. So Friday night, I go to Wissanoman meeting. Friday night, guy, Troubles. Troubles is in the room. I go up to him afterwards, but he doesn't want to be called Troubles, and he was a pretty rough dude, so his name was Bobby. I go up there afterwards and said, Bobby, I said, I need some help. I said, would you be my sponsor? He looked me dead in the eye. He said, Bobby, I've been watching you these past couple years, and I'm sticking my chest. I said, hey, he likes me. He says, I need to tell you. He said, you're full of shit. And I need to tell you, that's not the answer I'm looking for. He said, I'm going to be your sponsor under certain conditions. You're going to call me every single day. You're going to go to a big book meeting a week. You're going to go to a step meeting. You're going to a men's meeting. You're going to get yourself a coffee commitment. You're going to leave them damn women alone. And I'm talking to myself. I said, who's he talking to? I'm sober 25 months. I'm selling the grapevines. I got it going on. That's what I'm doing. Nuts. I didn't tell him that, though. What came out of my mouth was, I said, okay. I went back to his house that night. He introduced me to the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. He kind of used colorful language, which I needed to understand. I understood it, but he was sending me, conveying me another message that I didn't know what the hell. I didn't know nothing, and I should just keep my mouth shut. And that's what I did. And we went over the first 2 steps that night. No writing, no hopping on my wall, chanting to the east, none of this other stuff for 30 days. I know what's going on. Right out of the book. And then we said the third step. We got on our knees and said the third step prayers. Whoa. I'm getting on my knees like another dude, like saying prayers. I don't think so. I did. Said this prayer. And then we got done. And he said, Bobby, the way we do a third step, we pick pen and paper. I'm going to do a fourth step. I said, whoa. Easy does it. Let's keep it simple. How about I just not drink and go to a meeting? Well, that's what I was doing. I was not drinking and going to a meeting. I wanted to stick a gun in my mouth. I was just nuts. And so I did my food. I didn't want to do one of these. I'm going to meetings. Oh, I'm doing my inventory, stirring stuff up, you know, feel like going out. I want to eat my gun. You can't get no further out than that. So I did my 4-step, no big deal. Everything I wrote down, I did, not a big deal. That next step, that's a big deal. I'm a bright guy, got the angle on that. I call him up and say, Bobby, I'm going on a retreat this weekend. I'm going to do my 5th step with a priest. He said, Bobby, that's great. When you get done, stop by my house so you can do it with me. And you know how it is. You're on the phone with your sponsor sometimes. You're like you're deaf. Do you hear what I said? But before I could say something flippant, sarcastic, he said, Bobby, I'm your sponsor. I'm supposed to help you with these steps. These next two deal with character defects. I think I need to know what they are before I help you, even though I have a good idea. And he hung up on me. Now, the truth is, the reason I want to do, because my training as a kid, I knew whatever I said to the priest would be between me, him, and a lamppost. Nobody else would know, right? It's not to be spiritually enlightened. I got God on the list. I got the church on the list. I hate it. You know, the hate's still there. The truth was, I was afraid to go to my sponsor with that stuff because I thought that he would ridicule me. I thought he would pass judgment. Or even worse, he would break the confidence in whatever I disclosed to him and he would tell other people. Which kind of tells you my fear list quite isn't done. I never did that 5th step with that priest. I did it with my sponsor and he did none of those things. He did not pass judgment on me. He didn't ridicule me. To the best of my knowledge, he never told anybody else. In fact, what he did, he shared some of his experience with me, which took away the terminal uniqueness in which I thought I was the only guy to do certain things. Now, he had taken someone's life and he had gone to prison for that in the 60s, and that's not why I asked him to be my sponsor. The reason I asked him to be my sponsor, because he was walking the walk. It wasn't an hour and a half in AA. It was 22 and a half hours in the neighborhood. He had real friends. He had women friends. He wasn't inappropriate. He treated them with dignity and respect. And this was a tough dude, and he could have done whatever he wanted to do, but he no longer was a tough guy, like that way. You would never tell by the way the man carried himself. He was a true gentleman. He didn't use profanity. He was just treating people. He was doing the right deal. And that's why I was attracted to this dude. And that's why I asked him to be my sponsor. So even though I was familiar with his past. So we got involved in the steps. And I got better. You know? Now, I don't want to let you know that I woke up one day and I decided I was going to be a decent human being and got involved in the steps. I did not get involved in the steps through any volition of my own. Pain and desperation is what drove me to get involved in the steps. From the time I picked up the paper and pen to do the fourth step to the time I completed the fifth step, I'm not proud to tell you this, probably about 6 or 7 months passed. At this point, I'm probably sober 32 months. I only telling you that because please don't do it the way I did, because I don't know why I was able to make it without killing myself or anybody else. I now know God was looking out after me. But you know in how it works, it says we beg of you to be fearless and thorough from the very start, because they knew what the ramifications are if we play around with this program, you know. So 6 and 7, character defects. I don't know what these are. I mean, I know when I drank I was a character. Found out when I did my character, when I did my inventory, that I had no character whatsoever. I thought I was the greatest cop in the city. I thought I was a great uncle because I always supplied material goods to my nephews and nieces and this and that. And turned out I was none of those things. You know, because I didn't burn my fourth step when I did my fifth step, I had this in black and white for the next few steps. He told me I would need this information. I found out that I had no character whatsoever. I found out that I was a liar, thief, and a cheat. I wasn't dependable. I wasn't reliable. I wasn't the greatest cop in the city. In fact, I brought dishonor among my coworkers who served with integrity. I wasn't the great uncle that I thought I was because I missed key family events, or I was an idiot. I remember my sister got married. This is in the early 80s, 81, 82, the punk rock days. Now, I'm not a punk rocker, but I love dating them. They're a lot of fun. I like dating punk rockers. So I go to my sister's wedding. My sister gets married, and my date at the time, she wears a leopard skin miniskirt. My uncles liked it. My father didn't. I remember we got there late because we were three sheets to the wind and we were drunk, and I said, let's sit in the back pew, we don't want to cause a scene, right? I remember my sister walking down the aisle, and I can see the hurt in her eyes when she catches my act and who I'm with. My father's behind her walking down the aisle. I see a whole different look in his eye. I said, listen, they're probably going to go for pictures right now. It's probably a good idea that we don't show up. Why don't we go get a couple of drinks, you know? We'll slide into the reception. Things will be cool. She said, okay. She thought that was a good idea. We show up to dinner. Halfway through the reception, she trips over one of them stands, you know, that the servers put the thing on all the plates. She knocked all the plates on. You talk about being inconspicuous, you know? Like Southwest has those commercials now, you want to get away. You know, it was just nuts. It was crazy. But here I am, the happiest day of my sister's life, and I ruin it, you know? It's just, that's the type of dude that I was. And I tell people, I didn't have a spiritual awakening, I had a rude awakening. I see these stuff in black and white. I thought of myself in a certain light, but you know what? When you write that stuff in black and white, man, you get the evidence is right there. There's no disputing that, you know? Because I didn't burn my fourth step, half my eighth step was done. See, I used to be one of these guys, I never harmed anybody but myself. That should have been a tip off. I never did my inventory, because once I did my inventory, I found that I harmed everybody I came in contact with. And unfortunately, in my experience, those closest to me the most were harmed the most, you know. And because I didn't burn my fourth step, half my eighth step was done. And I had to throw more names down there. And if I wasn't had a willingness, I prayed for the willingness, you know. Getting back to the 6 and 7 real quick, the character defects, you know, the 6th step I had to become willing, and the 7th step was a prayer. But my sponsor says, Bob, you need to put legs on those prayers. I mean, I got a laundry list of character defects. Let's say sometimes I may not be the most patient guy in the world. You know, I have a little difficulty with that still. But I can pray all day long, God, help me be patient, help me be patient. But during the course of the day, should I be in a position to practice patience, and I don't, and I lash out in sarcasm, which is nothing but anger, also referred to as language of the Irish, but if I lash out, that prayer goes right out the window. God will do for me what I can't do for myself, but this is a program of action. I need to do this, and that's what the 7th step is. So the 8th step, I got the list, and if I'm not willing, I pray for the willingness. The 9th step, direct amends. No phone calls, no letters for me, because you know why? Because I didn't beat you with it back through the mail or over the phone, you know? And whenever I want to write a letter, I can give you any number of reasons. Oh, he moved out of the neighborhood. he lives in Florida, you know, one of those things. The truth is, I'm probably afraid. I'm afraid to face it. And I'd like to share two experiences on the ninth step. I'm at a meeting, this is about 17, 18 years ago. It's up in North Philadelphia, 11th and Rockland. This guy walks down the steps. I have not seen this guy since 1977. He is not on my fear list, not for any reason. It's just plain forgot. Out of sight, out of mind. You know, they say more will be revealed. I recognize this guy right away. He did recognize me. He walked down the steps, didn't recognize me. But I recognized him. He was a big guy. I used to like fighting big guys. I don't know why I wasn't good at it, but I loved it. People say he has heart. I was stupid. That's how I was. I didn't have heart. I was dumb. So one day I'm in a bar and we had kind of words and he kind of backed down. So from that point on, whenever I went to show anybody how tough or nuts I was, I would pick on this guy. You know, the verbal taunts, you know, the insults. And one day I slapped him, open-handed slap. He didn't do nothing. And then one day I spat upon him. I mean, the utter degradation of spitting on another human being, it doesn't get any lower than that. And he didn't do nothing. So I get introduced to speak. And I looked him dead in the eye. He's sitting in the second row. And I look him dead in the eye and say, my name is Bobby Coyle. I'm an alcoholic. Now I need to take a quick moment here and tell you why I use my full name. I know these traditions are top secret stuff. And we're not even going to mention the concepts. God forbid we confuse you. But, you know, these traditions are really confusing to some people for some reason. I don't know why. But no more so than this 11th tradition. All of a sudden we get sober. It's like we joined the mafia, you know. Everyone got a nickname. You know, there's John the Brick and Jimmy the Coat and Frank the Fox and Pepsi George and Red Sweater Jerry and Bucktooth Mary. You know, this goes on, right? Everybody in my neighborhood knows I'm a stark raving lunatic drunk. There's those little telltale signs. They come outside, I'm urinating on their car. My girlfriend throw the clothes out the window. Everyone knows I'm a drunk. God forbid my reputation should be tarnished by going to Alcoholics Anonymous. It's just nuts. God forbid, 3 o'clock in the morning, you feel like drinking, you call information. Yeah, I like that Frank the Fox's phone number. You got it? Or you want to go visit one of these beloved old-timers in the hospital. Yeah, I'm here to see John the Brick. Good luck. The 11th tradition is real clear. Personal anonymity at the level of press, radio, and films. That means you will never see my face clearly identified, followed by my full name, which is Robert Ignatius Benedict Coyle III, followed by the statement, is a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. You won't see that in the newspaper, you won't see it on television, or you won't hear it on the radio. That would be a violation of the 11th tradition. When a so-called celebrity says that he's in recovery or he is sober, that is not a violation. It is only a violation when he or she clearly states that he is a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. In fact, Dr. Bob, in The Good Old Timers, which is one of my favorite books besides the big book, Dr. Bob said, when one drunk is anonymous from another drunk, that's a violation of the 11th tradition. He went on to say that anonymity is spiritually inspired and secrecy is spirit inspired. This is not a secret society. However, I have no right to break your anonymity. I need to respect that. I was very involved in the area back home. We use our full names. I mean, you're not going to find Bobby C. in the phone book. And I dropped Benedict, even though that's back in vogue now. But you will find, if you ever want to, you want to track me down, I am in the phone book, Robert Ignatius Coyle III. I mean, that's there. 707 Sears Street. So, off that soapbox, back to the meeting, I looked this guy dead in the eye and say, my name is Bobby Coyle, I'm an alcoholic. Then he nodded, then he recognized me. See, I was told that making amends is much more than saying I'm sorry, because for me, the two words that don't mean squat. I was told making amends is about righting the wrong. Now, financial amends are easy for me. I go in the pocket and I pay you. If it's a large sum of money, I go on a payment plan. I just don't step to you and say I'm sorry. It's an act of good faith. I got to bring something with me. But the most important thing is you don't exercise that behavior again. But what about the emotional damage or the psychological damage? How do I make amends for that? I was told that I sit down and have conversations with people, tell them about my behavior, and again, not exhibit that behavior again. So, I figured if I publicly humiliated this guy, the least I could do was make amends to him publicly. It wasn't a grandstand. But when I said my full name, I'm Bobby Coyle, an alcoholic, then he nodded, then he recognized me. And at the end of my talk, I looked him dead in the eye, I said, Bob, I said, I'm truly sorry. I told the group what I used to do, how I treated this guy. And I said, I'm truly sorry the way I treated you. And as long as I stay sober, I hope I never treat you or any other human being the way I treated you. You know what? He came up and he hugged me. It was an incredible experience. Now at the end of the meeting, we start talking. I said, Bob, I ain't seen you in years. How you doing? He said, Bobby, I'm sober 3 years in Alcoholics Anonymous. I said, get out of here. Now the arrogance creeps in because everybody in Philadelphia knows me. I'm not saying that they like me. I'm just saying that they know me. I'm involved in service. People know me, right? Now, this meeting, I live in South Philadelphia, right? This meeting is up in North Philly. It's the 11th and Rockland. He's living up in Roxborough, which is considered like Northwest Philly, right? So this is a meeting that he and I normally would not attend. Philadelphia tends to be very parochial. You know, you stay in your neighborhood. So I said, what brings you here? He said, Bobby, I was flipping through the meeting directory, and I just want to go to a different meeting tonight. And when I flipped through the directory, for some reason, this meeting jumped out at me. Now, our meeting directory is 80 pages thick. We have 1,600 meetings a week in the city. And I am a firm believer that God, my God, put that guy in my path that night, and I had two options. I do what I did, or I did what I always did. Which? When you have 8 siblings in a 10-and-a-half-year span, there is a close resemblance. And people would come up to me and say, hey, you're a Coyle. I know you did. Oh, you got me confused. You're talking about my brother Brian or my brother Sean. Not me, you know. And I had to make amends to my brothers, you know. But that's what I did, you know. I'd like to share another experience on the ninth step. My home group for a while was a Stepping Stones group of Alcoholics Anonymous. I was at a business meeting one Sunday morning. I made a motion. Definitely was for the betterment of AA. It had to be since I made it. I wouldn't do anything else, you know. And so it's an amazing thing. My motion doesn't get seconded. Not every motion gets seconded, even the crazy ones, because you know it ain't going to get passed, but for no other reason you feel sorry for the poor dude's eye. You know what? That's a stupid motion, but I'm going to second it because I don't want to see it look bad, right? Unless the motion goes along the line like, all right, I think the last meeting a month we ought to have a quarter barrel in the back of the room. I can see that not getting seconded, but everything else is fair game, right? Not even more of a reason I was shocked, because my boys in the room, Freddie. I mean, we're making eye contact. I'm looking at him like I'm going in a fits, right? Like, he doesn't have my back, now, which he broke the rule. See, I grew up in a neighborhood, you always had your boys' back, right, wrong, or indifferent. There were certain rules. For instance, you couldn't do things like, you never dated anybody else's ex. You just don't do that. You say, you know what, I think you're cute, but you dated Frankie in the third grade, I can't talk to you. It is. It's a neighborhood thing, you know. You're out with your boy, he starts a fight, you have to get his back, you may get beat up over, but you and him could discuss that later, but you always got your boy. It's just, you're growing up in a neighborhood, that's what you do. I mean, so I'm looking at this guy, making eye contact with him, he doesn't second my motion. My motion goes down in flames, it doesn't get seconded. I come to the meeting, I never talk to him again. I see 4 or 5 guys in the room, I say hi to 3 or 4 of them, I will completely ignore them. One day I'm at work, my coworker comes up to me, he said, Bobby, Freddie Wheels is outside, want to take care of some sort of business? I peeked out the window, I said, tell him to take his fat ass down to City Hall, he can't do that here. A couple weeks later, that same coworker called me up, he said, Bobby, he said, Freddie Wheels died last night. And he said, the reason I'm calling you is because he always spoke so highly of you. As God is my judge, I cannot tell you what that motion was about. That's how petty it was. Here he was a guy placed in my path many, many times. He was a friend of mine. It shows you what type of friend that I was. See, when I thought I was going to get off my spiritual high horse, I would make amends when I thought it was right. Put my path many, many times. And the moment that my coworker said, Bobby, because you always spoke so highly of you, I felt about yay big. And I've been praying for Freddie ever since. See, that key word in the ninth step is wherever possible. Not whenever, you know. Whenever is time. For me, it's never the right time because I'm too busy, easy, doesn't it? Wherever. God will put people in my path. God will do for me what I can't do for myself. But this is a program of action. The 10th step, 4 through 9 on a regular basis. Now, if I want to stand up here and tell you I do a 10th step every day, that's not true. But I'm pretty good. 4, 5, 6 times a week. Sometimes 7. Sometimes 2 or 3 times a week, sometimes once a week, you know. Starts, you know, it's funny. I can now laugh. I think that's a gift in that. Yeah, I couldn't laugh when I first got sober. But you know what? I used to be one of these guys, if I'm not practicing these principles on a daily basis, no one knows but me. That's not true either. Because when I'm not practicing these principles, I operate in nitwit mode. And when I operate in nitwit mode, should you cross my path, you too are affected. I'm acting like a nitwit. You know, it's just not. But I can now laugh at myself, like, when you're going to get at yourself as SOB, you know? I can't stay sober on yesterday's sobriety, and I've been on some good loads. So, sooner or later, you come to, or you got to, you know, do some more things to keep that going. The same thing about sobriety, you know? I'm sober. It's contingent on my spiritual maintenance on a daily basis. That's all it is, you know. 11th step through prayer meditation. I pray and meditate on a daily basis. As a result of doing the steps, I've gotten some sort of spiritual contact. But I don't want to tell you how I pray and meditate for one reason only. There's a large group of people here. I don't want to insult anybody. If you want to come up to me afterwards, I'll tell you how I do it. You'll probably be disappointed because it's really nothing deep. But I just don't want to insult anybody, you know, because prayer and meditation is something that's really personal. And for you guys who have been meditating in the morning, how's that yogurt going? Did you bring your spoon? Every time Jimmy says, bring that mac, you bring yogurt in the morning, huh? Bring your spoon to yogurt. But, you know, I pray and meditate on a daily basis. And you know what? It may not be the way I was indoctrinated as a kid, but it's fantastic. And that was part of the journey. You know, I don't believe there's a wrong way of doing the right thing. You know, there's thousands of books on prayer. There's a thousand books on meditation. I think that's probably one of the fun of the journey. Pray and meditate in a way in which you feel comfortable. You know, I'm about to give you my opinion. I usually never give it. That's what the hospitality room is for. But I'm going to give you my opinion. If you give your opinion, you should clarify. This is my opinion. This is why I believe Alcoholics Anonymous is so successful, because you have given me the freedom to pray and meditate in a way in which I feel comfortable. If there were only one way to pray and meditate, I guarantee you I would not be here today. You would definitely have a different speaker. So I thank you for allowing me to experiment and find out what I'm comfortable with. The 12th step, having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps. That's the result. I've had a spiritual awakening. No burning bushes, no lightning bolts, no voices from above. In fact, it's been a number of years since I heard any voices at all. I'm truly grateful for that. We tried to carry this message. That's the message of Alcoholics Anonymous. Then the message is just don't drink and go to a meeting. That's what I thought it was. People say, just don't drink no matter what. Your ass falls off, put it in a wheelbarrow, take it to a meeting. Should your ass fall off, please go to the hospital, have it reattached. I hate to see you bleed. Hate to see you bleed to death. Just don't drink no matter what. That implies willpower. I can drink. If I can drink no matter what, why do I need to go to a meeting? Just don't drink no matter what. And, you know, I drank when I had a girlfriend, and when she left me for being a pig, I drank. I drank when I had a pocket full of money. When I broke, I drank. You know why? Because I took your money. 4th of July, Memorial Day weekend, October 3rd, it didn't matter. I drank no matter what. I tried to stop drinking. I tried to get stopped drinking because I got jammed up on the job abusing my sick time. I got to stop drinking because my girlfriend was going to leave me. One reason or the other. I tried to stop drinking for Lent and never made it to 40 days. Never made it 3 days, I don't think. I stopped drinking lots of times. My problem was staying stopped drinking. People say, just don't drink no matter what. That implies willpower. You know, that's not the message of Alcoholics Anonymous. The message of Alcoholics Anonymous is having a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps. If I 12-step somebody and don't mention God, I am lying to them. People say, God. Don't talk about God to a newcomer because you'll scare them. Well, if they're lucky, alcohol chaser, a butt right back here because I got nowhere else to go. Because left to my own devices, I'm a liar, thief, and a cheat. How can I claim credit for something that I can't claim credit for? I mean, left to my own devices, I already told you in a general way what the hell I'm doing here. I was an idiot, you know? But the most important part of that 12th step is to practice these principles in all my affairs. I'm only in an AA meeting an hour and a half a day. What about the other 22 and a half hours? What about the time in a job or the time in a neighborhood or the time with my family or friends? You know, I'm not the poster boy of Alcoholics Anonymous. I invite you to come live with me for a week. See what type of dude that I really am. I'm not the guy that I was 20 years ago. I make mistakes. But making mistakes doesn't get me drunk. It's not learning from those mistakes or defending those mistakes or justifying those mistakes. That's what will lead to the arrogance. That's what will lead to a drink. I'm just a regular guy from the neighborhood trying to do the right thing. And for most days, to be honest, I do the right thing most days, but I fall short. You know, but I get a great way of life. I then got involved in service, and I got a few minutes left, and I love service. I love the traditions. Traditions are to the group, what the steps are to the individuals. The steps are how it works, or the traditions are why it works. I remember I was sober a couple years, troubles, he wanted to take me up to Holmesburg. Holmesburg was a prison in Philadelphia, it's since been closed, they had a meeting on Monday nights. He called me up, he said, Bobby, we're going up to Holmesburg Monday night. I said, no, we're not. He said, yes, we are. No, we're not. You know how that goes with your sponsor, we go, right? However, he calls me about a week prior, like a Monday or Tuesday. So by Friday night, I realize I definitely can't go. He'll understand why. Because the Eagles are playing the Cowboys Monday night football. He definitely would understand. So I call him up. I say, Bobby, I can't go. I got the game, you know, Eagles playing Cowboys. He said, Bobby, you gave me your word. That's a commitment. Besides, if you pick up a drink, I don't think Randall Cunningham's going to come over and toss up your ass. And he hung up on me. Now, I really didn't want to go because, you know, I thought because what I did professionally, these guys, you know, I thought I would have to embellish my story, use profanity. He said, Bobby, they don't need to know what you did for a living, even though I want to tell them. He says, but they want a message of hope. You got a message of hope? That's what you tell these guys. So we go up there in prison work, you know, there's because we're guests. We don't compromise the message, but we are guests. We have to abide by their rules and regulations. So there's a process to get in there. Well, we show up. They don't show up. No one shows up. They're all on the block watching the game. Now I really got an attitude. And as I leave, I say some sort of flippant remark to the CEO and the gate. I said, oh, I guess you transferred all your alcoholics up to Greaterford. He knew what the hell I was talking about. So I'm driving down 95. I'm trying to get the game on the radio. He wants to talk. I said, oh, Christ, you shut up. I'm trying to catch the score. And he turns to me. He said, you don't get it. You're self-host SOB. We were here just in case they showed up. We are responsible for the effort, not the outcome. And 12-step work takes many forms and fashions. And I know prisons isn't for everyone, but I'm telling you, it's rewarding work. But I know it's not for everyone. And there's a lot of different 12-step committees. There's PI, public information, where you go to health fairs and carry the message. There's CPC. That's not PCP. That's CPC. Cooperation with the professional community. Actually, I saw they had a table set up. That's where you take an open. That's where you take a professional student to an open meeting. So for one day, when they're practicing their profession, whether they be a minister, a doctor, a nurse, they can refer a patient, a client, or a member of their congregation, Alcoholics Anonymous. Rewarding work. This committee, these guys, I've talked to some of your committee members. You guys have been working on this for 2 years. This is 12-step work. I'm a firm believer that everybody in this room has a gift. It may be different than the person sitting next to you, but it's your gift. You need to find what it is. Some of us are working with wet drunks. We do great work. Some of us balance checkbooks. Then there should some of us who should never, ever be allowed near a checkbook. The preamble says, our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. If I'm only staying sober and I'm not helping alcoholics, that's half measures, and half measures about us nothing. It doesn't say half measures about me half of something. Half measures about us nothing. Nothing. So, I am responsible when anyone anywhere reaches out for help. I want the hand of AA to be there, and for that, I am responsible. I can't be worrying about what you're doing. I get uncomfortable when people say politics, you know, service is about politics. Hasn't been my experience. My experience has been those involved in service have been some of the most selfless people I've ever met. Please, don't get me wrong. I'm a season ticket holder for the Phillies and the Flyers. I love my sports. I love the Eagles. I don't go to the games. Dealing with the drunks is just nuts. When I was a cop, I used to hate working those games. But don't get me wrong. I love to watch them on TV. But there's a lot of times there's a quarterly meeting. There's an assembly I go to. There's a committee meeting. And I enjoy service. Service keeps me sober. And that's why I do it. And that's my experience. It's not about politics. My experience is those who stay involved stay sober. That's why we do it. You know what? I finished up. I got a couple minutes left. You know, I've traveled the world. I've been all over. I was in Mexico in the early 90s. I thought I could speak Spanish because I worked in the barrio. My Spanish consisted of dame pistola, which means give me your gun. That's my Spanish. So I'm the only English-speaking person in this room. I'm in Mexico. I'm talking. You know, these poor people looking, what the hell is he saying? You know, they're probably saying that in Spanish. However you say that in Spanish, that's what they're saying, right? And I can tell by the look on their face they didn't know what I was saying, so I switch over English. God forbid I should be insulting anybody. And you know what? At the end of the meeting, they came up and they hugged me. And I can tell who the old-timer was by the serenity in their face, and I can tell who the newcomer was by their pain in their face. They may not have understood, but you know what? They understood. Language of the heart. It was an incredible experience, you know. I was very involved in service. I was on my way. I was going to be the youngest delegate ever to the General Services Conference in New York. Who that delegate was, how old they were, I don't know, but it was going to be me. You know, it was just nuts. Involved in service, and in 1993, I got diagnosed with lung cancer. Never smoked in my life. I'm a little reefer, but that don't count. But I never smoked a cigarette in my life. go through treatment, bounce back, do pretty good. Then I get sick again, and I get very sick. And, you know, I had surgery, and, you know, I'm just really sick. And I got out, I was laid up in the hospital, and I'm a meeting maker. I mean, with 1,600 meetings a week, there's no excuse not to make meetings. My favorite meetings are midnight meetings. You talk about midnight meetings. I mean, you got the people going to any length to get sober. You got the dudes with the capes and the ray guns, and you get those who work in second shift. I mean, midnight meetings is awesome, right? Well, I can't make meetings anymore. And then when I get out of the hospital, I'm laid up in my house. And people start coming to my house. I'm just not talking about friends of mine. I'm talking about people I may have met once or twice at the assembly, or people I never met before who are accompanying friends of mine. You're looking at a liar, a thief, and a cheat. I took from everyone. The only thing I gave was heartache and misery, and people come to my house to carry the message of Alcoholics Anonymous, you know. I was doing good for a while, I bounced back, and then I really got sick. I actually had my left lobe removed a little over 3 months ago. And I know, I don't look bad, I gained a couple pounds, I glow in the dark, you know. Actually, when I go back Monday, I have my 3 month scan, and so hopefully the surgery did the trick. The reason I bring this up, even though I may have had an excuse to go out and get loaded when I first got diagnosed, and I don't want you to think that I handled this well, like I'm this spiritual dude. I didn't. I had a very tough time. I'm young. I'm in my 30s at this time. I'm going to places and things like that. I had a very difficult time handling this. And but even though I had an excuse to go out and get loaded, I didn't have a reason to go out and get loaded. I got a pretty good life. I've been to thousands of meetings. I see some men and women go through some terrible things through their own, and they got through it without picking up a drink. Life on life's terms. That's what Alcoholics Anonymous promises me. None of the material things. The intangibles you can't put a price on. So it enables me to get through 24 hours a period of time without picking up a drink. You know, what's it like today? I got a great life. Still with the city. I'm no longer a police officer, so if you have a warrant, please relax. We got computers, fellas. You can't, you know, we don't. Back in the day, we used to misplace paperwork. That don't happen anymore. You got to take care of that stuff. Take care of that on your own, seriously. Because when you take care of it on your own, you have you're bargaining from a position of strength. You know, we pull you over and we run you. You're hot and you get pinched. So take care of that stuff. But I'm no longer a cop, but I still work for the city in another capacity. I love my work. Went back to grad school, got my master's from Penn, an Ivy institution. I now do counseling for the city. For the police and fire. I love my job, and working for the union, for the other city workers. It's just a great deal. It's a great job. What happened to that little kid? You know that saying that God takes care of drunks, fools, and kids? The trifecta. I hit the trifecta that day because the kid that I hit on that bike wasn't hurt that seriously. Thank God. Because if it were, it would change the dynamics. I would not be here today, more than likely. He wasn't hurt that seriously, and what made even things even more eerie, you know, coincidence, God's way of remaining anonymous, even though I did not know the kid personally, I knew his family. He came from a very large family neighborhood, and I had an opportunity to make amends to him. My mom died that day, and I was sober 4 years when I finally made amends to my father. My father forgave me, he hugged me, said, Bobby, that's what sick people do, you know. And that was probably the hardest thing that I ever did, you know. And I'll end with this, you know, I told you what my sobriety date was, June 2nd, and I really don't know if that's a date. I just made that up, and I'll tell you why. Because I told you my last load started Memorial Day weekend. And when I was at, finally went from Hahnemann to the VA hospital, I was in the VA hospital, I was reading the sports page one day. Counselor came up, gave me a hard way to go. He said, you should be reading this other stuff. He said, by the way, what's your sobriety date? And I says, I don't know. He said, well, if you don't know, you probably don't have one. I said, oh, crap. So I figured it out. Memorial Day was on Monday. I knew I got loaded Tuesday and Wednesday, but did I get loaded Thursday? I don't know. So I said, okay, I took Thursday. I paid it no mind at all until my first anniversary, actually the day before my first anniversary, June 2nd, my mom's birthday. So it's, you know, it's just amazing. So she's looking out after me afterwards, you know. It's a wonderful way of life. If you're new, I don't wish you well. Excuse me, I do wish you. I don't wish you luck. 40 inch slip. I love new people now. I don't wish you luck. Luck ain't got nothing to do with it. I wish you well. Get a home group. Get a sponsor. Make sure your sponsor's done the steps. I always see these controversial remarks for last because I'm done in 30 seconds. If your sponsor hasn't done the steps, he or she has no business sponsoring you. How do you find out they've done the steps? You ask them. You're going to hear two things. Yes or no. The person says yes, That's your person. Grab them. It's a wonderful way of life. I always use analogy of, like, I grew up in a neighborhood where everyone went to get a union card. It's a blue-collar neighborhood, right? You had electricians, iron workers. And the deal is, let's say you became an apprentice. Yeah, and that's what happens. You're an apprentice. You go to the job 4 days a week. You go to school 1 day a week. At the end of 4 years, you become a journeyman. That's what Alcoholics Anonymous is. You're a new person. You're an apprentice. You get yourself a journeyman. You get someone who's going through the steps. You go through the steps, you get your experience, you graduate from an apprentice to a journeyman. It's really that simple. Alcoholics Anonymous is a wonderful way of life. I do wish you well, and thank you very much for listening. That's all.